This is Lee Wilkins, and welcome to Thinking Out Loud. Here with me in the studio are two members of the New York Standards Quartet who are visiting guest artists as part of the We Always Swing Jazz series. So welcome, David Berkman and Tim Armacost.
Thank you. Nice to see you, Lee.
Okay, so I want to start a little bit back a bit. And jazz is one of those things that I think in some ways people say, oh, really? They're still doing that? It's not rap. It's not hip hop. It's not rock and roll. So tell me a little bit about where is jazz right now in 2019?
That's a big question.
Yeah, that's something we can sink our teeth into, I guess. I think for us, because I just turned 60 this year.
Okay.
So I've been playing jazz as professionally since I was, a teenager. So, for us, I think there's always like a trajectory that's personal, like the scene has changed, recording has changed, many things have changed, but a lot of things continue. And one of the things actually we're celebrating with this group, this is a band that's been together for the last 14 years. We've done 14 tours of Japan. This is our 7th record together. So for us, there's like a continuity thing of like, where's jazz? And I don't mean this in an egotistical way, but where's jazz today? Well, this is where we are as jazz artists, as people who've sort of committed to doing that. Mm-hmm.
And Tim, what about you? Where is jazz today?
Well, one of the philosophies of our band is we all came up playing both standards and original music. And we thought it would be interesting with this group to focus only on playing standard songs, but to play those songs with the approach that we take when we play our original music. So we create our arrangements in a way that gives us the opportunity to explore some of the contemporary problems that people are addressing in the sense of problem solving.
Mm-hmm.
If we have this problem of how do we do this in 7/4 instead of 4/4, we're doing that in the context of a standard. So what it does for us is it gives us a frame in which we can explore modern concepts, but it's also deeply connected to the tradition. And it's for us, it's very satisfying as musicians.
Well, and I would imagine that since you're doing standards for the average listener, for the average audience member, you start with a common knowledge, if you will, is that, this is what this song has sounded like in previous renditions.
Yes, and that's always been the appeal of standards, So Keith Jarrett for many years had an all standards trio that he played, after many years of writing original music. Then he went back to standards. And I think, standards are kind of like blank slates. You can sort of frame them in many different ways. And they still, I think the original appeal was that it would give audience members something to latch onto, and they could see what your particular take was on the standard.
So, Tim, you said that we're playing around with rhythm a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I get that. I think in some ways jazz has sort of always done that.
Yeah.
But what are the other sort of contemporary problems that jazz musicians are solving while we listen?
Yeah, the a big part of what's been going on in New York in the last 15, 20 years has been to do with odd meter. And people are writing highly complex structures. So not just playing a standard in 7 the whole way, for example, but writing a song that's structured with a bar of 7 followed by a bar of 4 and then 3 bars of 5. And it's a real challenge to try to find your way to navigate through those different time signatures. And people are addressing that with real enthusiasm. And one of the ways in which the music has developed is that in order to manage those rhythmic structures, people are kind of simplifying the harmonic content. So they write these highly complex melodies to go over these highly complex rhythmic structures. And the result of that is some really notey, very complicated sounding music. And what we're trying to figure out is how we can do that also with the beauty of the harmonic tradition that's carried through the Broadway songs. And when we find that balance, it's really attractive music for my ears, of course.
Yeah, exactly.
So David, you're the pianist of the group.
Yes,
and
I am.
Unless you're doing just the striking of the keyboard, the harmony I would imagine either originates from you or you get to pick up on it?
Well, I think it's something we all kind of share, but I do I probably write a little more of the music than more of the arrangements than anybody, but everybody contributes arrangements. And Tim is a very sophisticated arranger and harmonic being, so he brings a lot of interesting harmonic ideas to the table as well. You know, as does Gene Jackson, our drummer, who has contributed one of the pieces on this record. And it's a, you know, I think some people. You know, they're all the instruments have different roles, of course, and so I piano players tend to be very harmonically focused. But even there, I mean, I guess one of the things we do, I think we vary tunes rhythmically, we vary tunes harmonically. Also, one of the traditional things that bebop players did was to take a standard set of chord progression and write a new melody on it. So we do, those are called contrafacts in jazz education speak. And so we write some of those, but we're doing all these different things. Sometimes we'll write a new tune that just has a piece of the melody lifted from a standard. But we kind of look at, I think, the book that we're creating or the records that we're creating is kind of a comment and sort of a reaction to standards.
So I'm going to blow up one of my own preconceptions. One of the things that always scared me about even thinking about playing jazz was I would have to abandon the music. And the music.
You mean like the paper?
Yeah,
with the notes on it.
The paper part, yes. Right. And so, when you said, you know, you have arrangements, which means there's at least some paper, something like that going on. Mm-hmm. How does that all work?
Well, the idea is kind of to take the clothing that you usually hear a standard dressed in and change the clothes so that the melody is familiar and as we were saying before, you can latch onto it. That gives you something to latch onto. But then the clothing is different. So the relationship between the melody and the harmony is a new thing. And that gives us something to explore.
You know, there's one other thing. I think, we're trying to describe what some of the things that we get at. But, you know, music is a little more organic than that. And sometimes we just play a standard because we like the standard, you know. And it's not like it needs always to be altered. The other thing, and the last thing I wanted to say about that is, since we've been together for a long time, we've kind of evolved our roles within the band. And I feel like this band has its own approach to playing a standard, even when there's no real alteration. The band itself has a kind of voice.
And of course, to answer your question, you know, what your question is getting at is the improvisation part.
Yes, exactly.
And so we will redress a song in a new set of clothing or a new give the melody a new context. But after we've shown what that looks like, then the way I try to talk about it is I'm singing in my mind, and I try to just ask my fingers to deliver whatever melodies I'm hearing in my mind. And that improvisation is just a continuation of singing the melody. And we're finding new melodies.
But I think there's one difference. You said, you know, the thing that scares me about jazz is like having to get rid of the paper. I think most people who are jazz players who are drawn to this music, they're like, so looking forward to get rid of the paper, you know. It's like, so we come from a slightly different vantage point. You know, I was somebody who, when I was studying classical music, resented the paper and really was hoping to get away from it as soon as possible. So we definitely bring that sensibility.
Yeah.
Well, I was watching a film that was here a while ago with the True False Film Festival, 20 Feet from Stardom. And it's about the backup singers for a lot of rock bands.
I know that.
One of the things that they talk a lot about is the fact that you had a group of musicians who did backup vocals in the 50s who were very wedded to what was written on paper. And, of course, the women who came after them, and they are predominantly women, come from a church tradition where there's an awful lot of improvisation.
Sure.
And so they were coming at it from a completely different point of view.
Exactly.
And that's, so it sounds to me like, in a way, you have incorporated both. You still have some paper, you still have a plan, mm-hmm. but after that you also have what you're hearing in your head that in your case, you're trying to get out of the saxophone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
exactly.
That's right.
Yeah.
So one of the other things that We Always Swing does is it spends a little time educating people mm-hmm. about jazz. And so I'd like to talk to you a little bit about what your students that you've been here a while for several days, what are they thinking and do they get this? Is this dope for them?
Well, I'm not comfortable using that word. Are
okie dokie then. Sorry about that.
Well, I'm dating myself.
Well, I think we, you know, jazz, there's education is such a big part of jazz these days. You know, it's like almost every, I don't want to say every, but very often in playing situations, you're asked to do some teaching. And a lot of times we'll go to, you know, colleges and clinics and all that kind of stuff. We also both teach in New York. We teach at Queens College. Go Queens College. Go Mighty Raptors. I don't know what their team is.
Actually. That's okay. As long as they're not.
Oh. Are they?
I think we're the Eagles, yes.
Oh, okay.
Well, that's good. As long as we're not playing us in football, we're good with that. Right. So go ahead.
Yeah. In the jazz department, in the master's program at Queens College, we don't actually have a football team. So, but, you know, we're really involved in education a lot. And, you know, you see a lot of, we see a lot of the same sort of issues. I think, you know, the musical landscape has changed so much and recording has changed so much. And the tradition, the world that these students are coming into is very different than when I came to New York at 25 years of age and was going out every night to hear Kenny Barron and Mulgrew Miller and all these people in clubs in New York. Mm-hmm. The Village Vanguard, which is one of the iconic clubs in New York, costs $6.50 to go.
Mm. And you remember that well,
yeah,
right?
Because now I think it costs $35.
Oh, ouch. Yeah. Students can't afford that.
It's harder, you know, so it's a different world. And I think people keep changing. But, you know, everywhere we go, I think we're encouraged by the enthusiasm and being a musician is a very idealistic thing to be. You know, you think you can practice and get better and you kind of think that for your whole life. So we're the students that we encounter are definitely continuing that tradition. And we saw some good ones today.
Yeah. And to pick up on the point that David was making, when we got to New York, there was a generation of players the age that we are now, mm-hmm. and they were all about swinging. So when we arrived in New York in our early 20s, we would see these guys who'd been swinging for 30 years, and it was just breathtaking. And all I wanted to do was figure out how I could learn to play so that I could play with those amazing musicians. And so that generation of musicians is either gone or getting old. And there's less music. There are fewer clubs around now, and there's the atmosphere that the kids come to New York and other big cities is different now. It's a little bit more difficult for them to have access to that really breathtaking live swing. And yet, when they do hear it, they do respond. The young musicians that I'm in touch with, when they experience some deep swing, they understand the miracle of that. And they want to learn how to do it.
Since we're on the radio, can't see, but when you said that, your eyes got wide, you know, so it's like, oh, there's an epiphany there some sort.
Yeah.
I'm assuming that a lot of musicians do the same thing that journalism students do. It's all on the web. It's all about what you can get with this computer as I'm gesturing to the board here in the mm-hmm. studio. And it's also all about what I can do with this board. So how has that influenced either how you teach or how you think about the music itself?
Well, yeah, the jury is...
Lee asks really big
deep
questions.
Deep questions, yes. She really does. She goes for the heart of things. Yeah. And yeah, you know, I think the computer world and in the internet in general has changed things so much because everything is available. And yet, you know, there was a special thing to having one record, you know, and you usually had a favorite side. So that was 20 minutes of music. Sometimes I remember asking a student if they had a particular Herbie Hancock record that was very foundational for me. And I think it was Speak Like a Child. Anyway, the student responded, yeah, I had a friend give me 60 gigabytes of jazz, so I think it's on there. But you have to have a different, more personal relationship with the music than just owning it. You know,
having it on a hard disk.
Yes, having it on a hard disk. Yeah. So that's a challenge, you know. And I think some students are eating it up and, you know, like really consuming everything. And they are in touch with a lot of kinds of music that I had no idea existed, you know, when I was mm-hmm. their age. And then other students are overwhelmed by it. And they kind of, you know, they sort of miss that deep relationship with it. There's still something irreplaceable about hearing things live, you know, for me. So, you know, there's and yet you can, some of the clubs in New York stream music, and so you can be listening to, for Smalls Jazz Club is a club in New York that you know, you can go on their website and hear everybody that's playing in New York, you know, so it's a complex world. And I don't think there's a simple answer to that question, but I will find out, you know, we're going to see, we're sort of planting the seeds and seeing what happens, but the future is definitely going to be different.
The one of the things that's a huge improvement is the access to video. There's just an enormous amount of video that I didn't get to see. So I didn't get to see John Coltrane or Sonny Rollins or Stan Getz or Hank Mobley. I didn't get to see any of those guys on video. There were a few documentaries, but, you know, our television wasn't really showing them. And so that you can go on the web now and find all that video documentation of what came before. That's a fantastic resource.
And what is the video? Because, okay, so again, I think of music primarily as sound, not as sight. So what is the video add that I'm not gonna get from listening to John Coltrane?
That's an interesting question.
Well, I can remember the first time, after having heard Coltrane's quartet, like for many, many, many years, I remember the first time I saw them, and the piano player in that quartet is McCoy Tyner, and I remember looking at the video and watching him play and just like going, sort of saying to myself, oh, he's just playing the piano, just like a regular piano player. You know, I mean, obviously, I knew that intellectually he was playing the piano, it was the same, but somehow just seeing him do that thing, which I had seen myself do and other piano players do, it made it a little bit more approachable for me. And I think that was a little bit that experience. But I have to say, like, now you can hear some of the, even there is all that video library material.
Yes.
But then you can also hear piano players are recording themselves live in their house. Some excellent, a great pianist, Glenn Zaleski, is a young piano player in New York. And he does this weblog, and he puts, you can see him playing the piano. There's another camera pointed at his hands. You can see the chords he's using. I mean, there's the amount of information that is available to people is really just mind-boggling. But that's an incredible resource that I certainly didn't have any access to. Again, I think it's kind of a mixed blessing in a way, you know, because you sometimes just sort of puzzling over something and listening to it 1,000 times to try and figure out what it is better. And, you know, I teach a harmony class where I have people transcribe some piano recordings, and it's become very difficult to find one that hasn't been transcribed and put up on YouTube.
A
lot of the famous things are now there, you know, and so, and that's like watching someone else play something and seeing the music go by is a very different experience from listening to it and just like really trying to figure out it yourself at the instrument. That's so, an irreplaceable.
I imagine for me that's a little bit the equivalent of I assign an essay question in class and say, no, you may not go find this on the web. I actually want to know what you think. You know,
how do you know that they didn't search some of those things on the web?
Well, unfortunately, there are programs which I think are pretty kludgy, but I mean, it's, you know, it's back to your ideas. It's the learning happens when you're trying to puzzle it out for yourself.
Exactly. Yeah,
or at least I think that that's what's going on.
I agree. Yeah.
So what are the, we talked a little bit about standards. So for our listening audience, give us a few names of songs that we might recognize and might think of as standards. I might not have the same that you all do.
Well, I think if you go to New York Standards Quartet
.org,
okay,
you just look at all the things that are there, and that's pretty much all the music you need. Period.
Uh-huh. I see.
You can
okay.
purchase CDs there, and that's pretty much.
So this is a shameless plug, and
we'll
just go.
I really
go
don't
with
feel
that.
Like there's any need for anything else that we have. No, I mean we're talking about the American Songbook. We're talking about George Gershwin. We're talking about
Irving Berlin.
Sure, you know, a lot of that kind of material, and then songs that have become like Giant Steps for John Coltrane, songs that musicians, tunes that have become played so much that they become standards.
We have on our new recording, we have one of my arrangements on a Leonard Bernstein composition called Tonight. And
this would be from West Side Story,
right?
Stories.
So yes. I like to tell the story because it's a nice one that, you know, I practiced for years. I practiced in apartments. And I was always putting stuff down the bell, you know, putting socks in my bell or T-shirts and trying to keep it as quiet as possible for the neighbors. And I finally got to move into a house a few years ago up just north of New York City. And I was playing along one day, and my neighbor across the street called up and said, I love your playing. And I said, really? You know, I'm just repeating stuff over and over again when I practice. He said, no, I love it. He said, do you know anything from West Side Story? And I said, oh, I'm getting requests for in my practice time. How interesting. And I said, well, of course, I love that music, but I hadn't ever learned any of the songs to play them. And he said, well, I just love tonight. And I said, you know what? I'll have a look right now. So here we are in 2017, this was, or 18. And so I was sitting next to my computer, and I pulled up on YouTube. I pulled up Tonight from the actual, you know, the Broadway production. And that song is just so beautiful. And there actually wasn't that much I needed to change to modernize it. I just made a little rhythmic frame for it. And we pretty much used the harmonies exactly as Bernstein wrote them. And I just started playing by myself, and I was getting emotional. Just the first time I played this song with my neighbor listening. And I finished playing for a little while, and he and some gardeners who were outside clapped for me.
Oh, that's pretty terrific.
And
clapping instead of calling the police. Yeah, well done.
Well, that is good. Because that's what you worry about, you know. Yes. So I got into it and eventually wrote this arrangement, and we've been playing it. I've actually made a big band arrangement for it, too. So I have a lot to thank that neighbor for right now.
So I want to get back a little bit to the teaching part of this. So tell the audience, you've been working primarily with Mizzou students, right? Or have you been into the high schools as well?
Well, we actually had elementary school students. And in fact, we have a story very similar to that. We got a request for Baby Shark, which I don't actually know.
Oh, it's an earworm.
Yeah.
My grandkids know it.
Yeah, so, you know, maybe that'll be the next record, like tonight. You know, we have a very similar story, and that five-year-old kid hopefully will come to the gig and say, wow, you made Baby Shark. It's really great.
Well, but I'm just curious, what do young children, are they just fascinated because it's music, and maybe it's not the music that mom and dad play all the time or music that they hear in church? Or, I mean, where's their entree to all of this?
Well, what we did this morning was we kind of broke it down and showed them how the band functions.
Oh, okay.
And so I just had Gene, our drummer, Gene Jackson, I had him play a simple pattern on the ride cymbal, and I got the kids to say, spang-a-lang, spang. Along with the way he was playing. And then we showed him where the hi-hat was and the bass drum, and then we played some kind of complex rhythm, and we had the kids naming the things that he was doing with his drum set. So we got them involved in what it feels like to sit at the drums. And then we added the bass to that and talked a little bit about how the bass is the soul of the band, and the drums are the heartbeat, and David, the harmony is the brains.
Yes, there you go.
And I'm the, as the saxophone,
mouth, the mouth.
I'm the voice.
The mouth.
Uh-huh.
Oh, voice.
Voice,
yeah,
is
that's
nice.
It.
That's good.
I thought mouth, but okay.
So we kind of broke it down and played a blues and showed them how we relate to each other. And they seemed to be fascinated by that, which was
yeah, fun. I think one of the barriers to jazz is that sometimes there's a lot going on, and it's sort of hard to sort out exactly what the situation is. You know, one of the things that some people don't realize about jazz is that we're playing on a chord progression, and it repeats, and there are choruses, you know, and it's like when we talk about playing on a song like Tonight, what that means is you play the chord progression that the melody is written on, and then you stop playing the melody and you start playing something else using that same chord progression. That's not the only way that jazz forms exist, but that's a pretty common way. And I think a lot of people struggle to hear that. In the same way that understanding, you know, sonata allegro form or whatever, or what a fugue is, that helps you appreciate classical music on a deeper level. You know, sometimes knowing something about the structure makes it more intelligible. When I first went to college, I remember my roommate was kind of a non-jazz fan, and I was playing all these jazz records. He said, man, the music you play, it just sounds like, you know, just like to him, it was random, unrecognizable sound. Like, so if you don't hear any structure, then it's not very compelling.
Well, and I think for a lot of us who spend a lot of time listening to rock or pop or, you know, whatever, we're so used to the hook.
Right.
And we know that the hook is going to come around.
That's right.
And I think that's a structural thing as
certainly.
Well. So, you know, cluing people into, well, here's the equivalent of the hook, or here's the equivalent of
right.
the chorus. And you can sort of listen and
well,
and
a lot of people
prepare
don't,
for that.
And a lot of people have a hard time listening to music that doesn't have words. You know, like for a lot of people, the song is the words, you know? So it's like, it's different. You know, I think in pop music, a lot of times, it's not a chord progression structure necessarily. The solo might happen over different material, and it's more just sort of a telling a story or spacing or something like that, you know, but every music has its own kind of structure. And I think, I do think that the structure to jazz music is maybe a little hard at first.
Yeah.
Well, but Tim, when you were talking about your neighbor requesting tonight, that's really funny because in my mind, I hear the words, but the words are the melody. I mean, they go together.
Yeah. Well, and that was the art of constructing those songs, right. You know?
Well, I think it's one of the things that makes the musical memorable, but also Bernstein's contribution, because I think about that musical as being some sort of fabulous meld between jazz and classical with mm-hmm. a little bit of rock and roll thrown in, and it's kind of all there.
And some Shakespeare, too.
Yeah. Well, yes.
Really, really something special, that show.
Yeah. I mean, a good story never hurts. That's the writer.
Yeah, that's true.
So the little kids were interested in, I'm so sorry we got Baby Shark in this conversation, but that was probably inevitable. The whole audience now has earworms.
I have never been exposed to that one. Yeah. So for me, it's
you
really...
You haven't.
No. Well, maybe you
have lived a sheltered life, David. That's all I can say.
You're going to have to look it up.
Yeah. I think maybe better not.
Yes, it's there are many versions of it on YouTube. So that's what the younger kids are interested in. Mm. What are you getting out of university students? Hopefully not just Baby Shark.
No, actually no university students requested Baby Shark on this particular tour.
I think as we worked with this afternoon, we're working to learn how to play small group jazz together. And our job for the afternoon was to kind of coach them through the songs that we're going to play tonight, give them some pointers on how to play together. And, you know, they were in our arena with us. They were very much interested in what we're doing, and they're trying to learn how to play jazz.
Right. They've already gone through those initial steps, and they're kind of figuring out how to polish their skills. Yeah.
So when you say learning how to play together, I'm assuming that part of that is literally kind of knowing what the other people's moves are going to be, either sort of as they're making them or perhaps even a little bit in advance. Is there more to it than that? Not that that's not a lot.
I think, you know, it's a particular set of skills that being a jazz musician involves. And some of them are things that, you know, you have to both play the chords and know that you can improvise over them and not forget the progression, and then also have different ways of playing the chords.
There's
and
a
then,
lot going on up there, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I think it has to get internal. Like, you can't really notice the other people when you're struggling to, like, have your mind on all the details that you have to take care of. When some of those details are more internalized, you can sort of notice, oh, that guy's playing really loud. Maybe I should play loud. Or he's playing really soft. Maybe I'm playing too loud. Or maybe I'm playing too much because that other person, I can't hear them at all. You know, things like that. Mm-hmm. But sometimes you're so busy with what's right in front of your face that you can't sort of take in the whole group. And I think that's a lot of what the learning process is for jazz, is like getting enough familiar with the rudiments that you can get past them to see what else is going on and how you can participate in a group experience.
Yeah. Well, and I would imagine that some of that only happens with time and practice.
That was what I was going to say, is we've been together as a band for 14 years. So we've now developed enough common language and common experience where if we get up on the bandstand and we haven't seen each other for 3 months, we just pick up where we left off. And we will do two or three tours a year where we're playing every night for 2 to 3 weeks. And, you know, by the third night, we've played everything we know, so now we're just exploring together. And that's just a beautiful experience. And one of the stories David tells sometimes when we're doing workshops is because we've played together so much, we know each other's habits, and I know how he sounds. So if David, while I'm soloing, if David finds something in the accompaniment that he's never found before, I'm going to hear that because I've never heard it before, and I've played with him a lot. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So that gives me the opportunity to say in the music, oh, wow, that's kind of interesting. Let's explore that. And now we're going into an unfamiliar room together. And that's just a kind of an irreplaceable experience. You have to play a lot together to arrive at that level of knowing each other.
And that is one of the real joys of being in a band. You know, like, the other thing is, you know, you can be having sort of a mediocre night yourself, and you're riding on something. You actually, like, you sound better. It's better than the sum of its parts because it has its own sort of energy and its own sort of sound quality.
Well, I think there's a whole bunch of other people on the stage who want you to succeed. And I think that sort of group camaraderie, group support actually is really helpful in the middle of a performance.
For sure, yeah.
Yeah, and I can definitely say that I appreciate, particularly Gene and Tim, who we've been together the longest in this band. You know, I think I appreciate their playing and their development as musicians and artists far more now than when we started. So that's like a good indication that we're all growing together in a positive direction.
Yeah.
So after you're here in Columbia, I'm assuming you're going back to New York. What comes next?
Well,
the next thing for the band is a tour in Japan.
And when will that be?
We start on July 19th, and we're going for 2 solid weeks, playing almost every night. We've been there 13 times. This is our 14th?
Yeah,
14th year
tour.
Going to Japan, mostly in the summer.
And so my thing is, no, American jazz doesn't sound a thing like what I associate with Japanese music. The audience is different, smarter. Do they ask for different stuff? Less rockin'. I mean, how does that work?
So far, no one's asked for Baby Shark.
Oh, yeah. Well, trust me, it's an international phenomenon. You'll get there.
Okay.
They are very sophisticated jazz listeners. And one of the things that we get to experience is, you know, there's a bit of a cliche about the Japanese culture that it's very buttoned down and held in. And in fact, jazz listeners in Japan love to have a beer and loosen up and really get into the music. So we get a really strong exchange with Japanese musicians, Japanese audiences rather. We'll play something, and if that sort of spark that happens when we are finding something, there's somebody in the audience who's going to go, whoa, yeah, in Japanese. And and that gives us energy, and we respond, and then the energy builds. And we have, in Japanese, they call it moriagaru, which means the music is boiling. It's reaching a boil.
So in American, we would say you start to cook.
Exactly, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. And that cooking is not just in the band, but it's in relation to the audience. Mm-hmm.
The other thing about Japan and jazz in Japan is they've had generations of their own great players. I mean, there's been a lot of really great Japanese jazz musicians over the years. It's a little maybe sort of comparable to baseball or something.
Sure.
You know, there's like so some countries that we go to, jazz is a really new thing for them. And so they don't have the same level of sort of awareness and the same level of generations of players that have come and the same clubs. They have clubs that have been there for, you know, 20, 30, 40 years in some cases. So it feels in some ways more like the United States in some respects than...
Yeah, it has to do with the Army being there after the war, after World War II.
Of course, I hadn't thought about that, but yeah.
There were you know, large numbers of American servicemen, mm-hmm. and among them were bands. And then you also had bands coming through from America to entertain the troops, and the Japanese could also hear those groups. In Japan and England in particular, we had large populations of our soldiers. And those two countries, especially, there are many other countries around the world, but in those two, in my experience, there are very strong local traditions that started from those Japanese and English musicians learning from Americans. You know,
well, and
I
think in that sense, you're speaking an international language, which I know is
very much
of a cliche. But it's
but true, yes. Exactly.
Yeah, well, it was a little bit of truth in it.
Also for us, Gene is married to a Japanese woman, and so am I. And my wife she's a great Japanese actress, TV
Wonderful.
Actress. And so she's over there right now. And Gene is going back to Japan right now. So we're also, I think, interacting more and more with Japanese musicians. We'll be doing a sextet gig at the end of the tour, playing mostly my music, actually playing all my music. And that'll be with a band that's half Japanese and half American. So we're also making some connections in that scene. We did a Japanese big band performance last year, a couple of performances with that. And that was an all Japanese band except for the four of us, three of us.
And since you have family members involved, there's no pressure at all, right?
Yes. Well, yeah, that's true.
Well, I wish you much good luck on your performance this evening.
Thank you.
But in the meanwhile, thank you both, Tim and David, for coming to talk to us at Thinking Out Loud. It's been our pleasure, and I'm sure our listening audience will be listening in many, many ways.
Again, thank you, and happy Jazz Appreciation Day.
There
and
you go.
Also happy Duke Ellington's birthday.
Right.
Yes.
And happy Tim Armacost's son's birthday.
Okay, any other birthday wishes?
I think we can leave it at that.
All right, this is Lee Wilkins for KBIA's Thinking Out Loud.